They'd heard it had come from Egypt, running down the mountains and along the plains, sparing no one along the way. As soon as they could, Cassia and her family locked themselves in their insulae, and they'd hardly ventured out since. As she peered through the slats, she could see that there was hardly anyone on the streets now. Neither the tradesmen in their stalls or the soldiers in their uniforms. Everyone was staying at home. It was quiet at first, only the trundling cartwheels carrying the dead along the flagstones. But these days, there was a different sound that filled the air. Their apartment block was full of panic, full of cries for physicians, full of the shouts of fever dreams and demons, and full of the endless, unanswerable beating of doors. Friends, neighbors, pleading for help. But Cassia couldn't do a thing.
Welcome to the Eastern Roman Empire in the 6th century, and to the second episode of our History of Pandemics season. This time, we meet a plague that historians and medical experts alike agree was humanity's first recorded pandemic caused by this deadly disease. You might not have heard much about Emperor Justinian I, or why he has a plague outbreak named after him. But by the end of this episode, you'll hear just how devastating and long-lasting this pandemic was. So, I'd like to introduce you to Mike McCormick, Professor of Medieval History and Chair of the Science of Human Past Initiative at Harvard University, who can set the scene for us.
We are in the year of the Christian era, 542, actually late 541 for the first outbreak, apparently in Egypt. But we get detailed information about what's going on in the spring of 542 from an eyewitness at the center of the world, as far as the Mediterranean was concerned, Constantinople, New Rome, capital of the Roman Empire. The emperor was Justinian, one of the greatest emperors of all time in terms of his architectural achievements, in terms of his legislation and his codification of Roman law. The Justinianic Code, of course, is responsible for almost everything we know about classical and post-classical Roman law, and a number of tremendous conquests. He set out to reconquer the lost provinces of the West and recovered the two richest, Italy and Africa, Africa and Italy in that chronological order. And in 542, he had overcome a violent uprising in the capital, which had burned most of downtown. He was in the process, he had been rebuilding fast and intensively, including the building of the Hagia Sophia, the largest building in the ancient world, 16 stories tall, one of the greatest architectural innovations and creations of the ancient world, with a gigantic dome, and was rebuilding across the Roman Empire. Africa had been conquered, triumph ceremonies had been celebrated. Italy, the war was grinding on. It had gotten off to a great start, but had slowed down with the severe climate downturn, which has been termed the late antique Little Ice Age, that began in the spring of 536. Suddenly, across Western Eurasia, average summer temperatures dropped severely between 1.5 and 3 degrees centigrade, which is a lot on average for summer temperature. And the cause for this was recently identified in 2015 as a massive volcanic explosion, or actually three volcanic explosions that occurred in rapid succession from 536 forward. So the Roman Empire and the post-Roman space was wrestling with severe climate change, severe and swift climate change that was affecting crop productions and where different things were produced, but was displaying considerable resilience when this terrible event broke out.
Mike feels that Justinian himself got a bit of a raw deal.
Poor Justinian, he fought against incredible odds. Imagine you had a new Little Ice Age dropped on your head, and you just were reconquering the lost provinces, and you just overcome this gigantic revolt. You were building the greatest structure the Roman Empire ever put up, and repairing the largest aqueduct, and expanding the largest aqueduct the Roman Empire ever built to feed the water-poor site of Constantinople. You just published a codification of Roman law and of all the great class, the digest of all the great classical jurisprudential writers of the 3rd century. And boom, you get this damn thing dropped on your head, first of all, and then you get it named after you. Of course, it wasn't remembered as such. It was simply called the death, the dying, the mortality, the great mortality. That's a modern name. And Justinian was taking claim for everything happening in his period. So in a way, it's just desserts that modern scholars have named it after the emperor in whose reign it broke out and in whose capital we have the most vivid and horrifying descriptions of the first outbreak.
Yet we're not just talking about an isolated outbreak, more a longer period of disease emerging and then dying down again.
That is the consensus. That is to say, a series of outbreaks recurring every 4 to 10 years in different places around the Roman and post-Roman world from 541, 542 to about 750. There's some discrepancy on the dating of the last outbreak. Was it 764? I've written a lot on it, but I forget the details. You can look them up. And I worked out the chronology from my perspective with the evidence I had in my book on the origins of the European economy. There's a little appendix and it tracks just look up plague in the index and you'll get the details.
And as far as we're aware, this is the first time humans encountered what we now call the plague.
Let's even be more clear. The first historically recorded plague pandemic. It's entirely possible that plague pandemics may have occurred in unrecorded times and places before this. Molecular biology, archaeogenetics, has the power to reveal that. So we have to stay tuned and remain open now that we know that this organism existed for hundreds, even thousands of years before Justinian. We have to allow for the possibility that future discoveries may be every bit as stunning as the recent ones.
So how do our sources describe it?
The sources identify it as inguinal plague or inguinal plague, an epidemic that causes swelling in the inguinal area in the thighs in the form of buboes, sometimes also cervical in the neck and other places. Identification of the pathogen was controverted for many years. The descriptions of symptoms in the historical eyewitness reports did seem to point pretty clearly to bubonic plague. It's clear that Alexandre Yersin, the Swiss biologist who was sent by Louis Pasteur to East Asia during the second pandemic to see what was going on, it's clear that he identified the previous bubonic plague, the Black Death of the Middle Ages, what people call the second pandemic of plague, and probably the first pandemic as well. He thought they were clearly bubonic plague. But debate raised because one could make different arguments from the sources, and the Greek and the Latin is challenging. The languages aren't in a state of evolution at this time, and it requires great philological insight to be able to understand them correctly. And we're better off now with the kind of computerized digital tools that we have. And so, although the debate continued, legitimately so, most scholars were inclined to think from the symptoms that it was bubonic plague.
What do we know about those sources? How much can we trust them?
It's important to understand that the evidence, the written, the historical evidence is rich, but it's quite uneven. It's particularly rich for the first outbreak, which starts in 542 and goes for 2 or 3 years. After that, the sources become more jejune for everything, including for plague, and that continues. Nevertheless, historians and archaeologists working from the written evidence have identified from those written sources between, depending on how you count, between 18 and 32, I believe, epidemic outbreaks of plague around the Mediterranean world and its hinterland between 541, 542, and the last great outbreak in the middle of the 8th century. The first and the last are among the most, those that are documented in the written sources in greatest detail. Most of the places where we have plague now, most of those places are not documented as having been affected by plague in the Justinian pandemic. At most, the region is indicated. To my own sense, the discovery of ancient DNA of plague in Anglo-Saxon Britain was truly surprising. Others had made the case, but I thought that the written sources remained arguably ambiguous about it. There can now be no doubt that plague hit Anglo-Saxon England, a small rural cemetery south of Cambridge, memory serves. Edict's Hill is the name of the place. And what's really striking about that and tells us something about how this world of Justinian was so tightly connected is that genetically, the form of Yersinia pestis identified in those victims in that Anglo-Saxon cemetery looks to be closest to the base, to the beginning of the pandemic, which suggests very swift communications from the Egyptian Delta to Anglo-Saxon England in the 540s. That's quite remarkable.
It sounds like it's fair to say that there's a great deal we don't yet know about this pandemic.
We are at the very beginning of our knowledge and understanding of this phenomenon. I myself, quite honestly, as a young assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins University, didn't think much of plague. How could a tiny microbe bring down a mighty empire? I had a graduate student who said, no, Mike, the plague was really important and you should study it. So I looked into it a little bit. I said, well, maybe, but you couldn't tell much. Everybody was arguing about what it was and whether absence of evidence is evidence of absence and so forth. And I didn't pay much attention to it for the next 15 years, until I began studying shipping and communications. And that's how I personally got interested in the story of the Justinianic pandemic, because it is a disease of rats. It is not a disease of humans. Its classic form of transmission is the transport, the passive transport of infected rats and their fleas from one place to another. And so I was working on shipping and communications in the late Roman world, in the early medieval world, and it quickly became clear that outbreaks of plague were signals of the arrival of a ship from somewhere. And indeed, this is explicitly documented in a few cases from the Justinian pandemic. So I began studying it as a proxy for seafaring communications, and only later began to realize the potential importance of it for the economy overall as a causative factor for change in the economy, in the demography, and indeed in the culture itself.
And Mike feels there's a lot more we could learn from studying how the plague spread in this period.
The host population of Yersinia pestis in the Roman Empire, Ratus Ratus, is another avenue that needs tremendous research devoted to it. It is now established that the black rat was well established in the Roman Empire. They do not travel long distances, according to the zoologists, under their own power, under normal circumstances, so they're passively transported. So the presence of black rats allow you to follow the spread of the Roman transport infrastructure. They piggybacked on this amazing communications infrastructure that the Roman Empire constructed in terms of ships, riverboats, and carts to move around the empire. And the study of the archaeology of the rat is in its infancy, but it is a very high-performing technique that is becoming more common in Mediterranean archaeology now and will doubtless allow us to trace the spread of the black rat. We may be able to get evidence of Yersinia pestis from the rats themselves, or at least from the genetics of the evolution of the rat over time and space, which may shed unexpected independent light.
I was keen to know more about the situation in Justinian's capital, just as the plague hit.
It's clear that what happened in 542, 543 in the capital was horrific. We have two eyewitnesses, Procopius, who is the legal counsel to the most successful general in Justinian's army, the great general Belisarius, who had led the reconquest of Africa and Italy and thwarted the Persian invasion and would play a very important military role at various times in Justinian's reign. And the second eyewitness is also someone who, like Procopius, was very close to the imperial court, John of Ephesus, who was a monk from Mesopotamia who adhered to a variant Christology from the emperor. The empress Theodora adhered to the Christology of John of Ephesus, and John was close to the empress. So both Procopius and John of Ephesus saw this with their own eyes, and they were very close to the imperial court, indeed had been present at the imperial court on multiple occasions. And what they described is quite terrible. Starting in the spring, a new disease, or a disease that for them was new, and it caused a total cessation of activities in Constantinople. Those who've been in Manhattan or perhaps London during the pandemic will read the pages of Procopius describing how there was no one on the street. The markets were still There was no one in the uniform. The civil service in the late Roman Empire wore uniforms, as in Tsarist Russia. The government itself had come to a halt, and the mortalities were huge. Body disposal was a great challenge. According to John of Ephesus, you can believe him or not, but he claims that Justinian wanted to find out exactly how bad the mortality was and set accountants at the gates of the city to count the bodies being counted, being carried out, and gave up in despair when they hit 230,000. In any case, it's clear that mortalities were very, very high. The emperor became involved in body removal, assigning troops and special forces from the palace to do this and hiring people to do it. It's clear from the richest Latin eyewitness and contemporary, Gregory, Bishop of Tours, who is writing in the 580s or 590s, although he was a small child at the time and he doesn't remember it directly, but the one that he experienced most intensely himself was the outbreak of 571, and it's quite clear that that was a devastating outbreak in Gregory's experience of it in his hometown of Clermont, where he was a member of the cathedral clergy. It killed the bishop and a relative of the bishop, among other people. Gregory himself is really a very rich witness, but a kind of an uneven witness again. He mentions it about 20 times in his histories and in his various hagiographical work. Interestingly, saints are curing everything in Gregory of Tours. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of miraculous cures in Gregory of Tours. There's only one cure of bubonic plague. Everybody else doesn't make it in Gregory's account. He also describes other epidemics of what seem to be other pathogens. He refers to six epidemics that he's aware of between 543 and about in the early 590s. And he treats four in greater detail, and particularly the first outbreak at when he was 4, 5, or 6 years old. And he knows through his elders, and the one of 571, as well as one which his deacon, who had been sent to Rome to collect relics, experienced it firsthand, and provides a striking, brief, but striking eyewitness account of that outbreak.
Our other source is John of Ephesus. What does he tell us about the experience of this disease?
The problem with John of Ephesus is he gave a bunch of sermons about the plague. He's preaching to his monks about how sin, you know, blah, 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 blah. But then he recycled the sermons in his church history. And then the church history was lost, and it's only preserved in quotations from other writers, from later writers.
But Mike and I did discuss a very interesting quote from John of Ephesus, which references an emerging divide between the experience of the rich and the poor.
Initially, the plague killed vigorously the poor people who were dumped in the streets. Pestilence reached the capital. This is my summary of it. Pestilence reached the capital and killed the poor first, so they would be buried with dignity, understood by the rich, who themselves would not be buried. So that's in John of Ephesus. It's in his fourth account in the fragments that survive.
Moving on to the burials that John mentions, what do we know about what happened during this first outbreak?
First of all, the evidence of anomalous burials, not just mass graves in which you have five or more people, but exceptional frequencies of multiple burials, burying two people simultaneously together with no sign of violence, or three people together, and burials in anomalous circumstances, people who show no sign of having died violently, being buried in construction trenches, or in wells, or unusual body disposal. In the ancient world, bodies were treated with great respect, and people were expected to care for them and to venerate and to continue to commemorate the memory of their ancestors through visiting the tomb and annual ceremonies and prayers and masses and what have you, so that any disruption of burial ritual in this society, which really attaches a lot of importance to it, is striking. It's also quite clear that at the beginning of the outbreaks, exactly as we have experienced tragically ourselves, the death rate was relatively modest and the normal rituals were performed. Procopius, and I believe John of Ephesus, say this explicitly, but as the bodies piled up in the streets, this went by the boards. and new forms of dealing with the dead were forced to emerge. Unfortunately, it's another one of the tragic insights that I've had since March, as we've lived through this together. I did not really get that section of Procopius in which he says, you know, sometimes it was 1,000, sometimes it was 2,000, even 10,000 a day. I just didn't get it. What does this mean? We're sitting here every day counting how many died in Boston, in Massachusetts, in the United States, in the world. And we're saying, oh my God, we're, you know, right now we're down to like 17 or 16. We're real happy in the state of Massachusetts. And I understood tragically why everyone who lived through that in Constantinople remembered the day counts. I don't know whether he's exaggerating or not, but I now understand that everyone who read that, and he was writing only a few years afterward, and he was certainly read by the elite of the Roman Empire and beyond. Everybody who had lived through that had a shiver remembering the day counts, the counts of daily dead. John of Ephesus says that Justinian wanted to know and had accountants, logothetes, professional accountants working for the imperial fisc and the imperial government that are out there doing the counting. And the Romans counted. Believe me, they counted. They had very detailed records. They don't survive. You paid your taxes. You paid customs dues. They had guys sitting at the bottom of the gangplank when you came down. And they even found a tablet from the second century at the bottom of a wharf in Marseille with it's a wax tablet. You know, that was their little notebooks in antiquity because you could erase the wax with a smooth thing. And it has the initials for the Praetorian Prefecture of the Gauls. This is the tax collector sitting at the, and he dropped his damn tablet in the thing. And he probably caught hell from his boss for losing count of how many sacks of whatever it was for demons. So the Romans had these records, but they don't survive.
I found it fascinating that Mike was discovering something new in texts that he's been reading for years. As a scholar myself, I often find this, noticing new connections and subtle nuances in philosophical texts that I've been studying for decades. So I was curious to know if anything else had emerged in Mike's rereading of these ancient sources during our current pandemic.
The effect on people's psyche. In particular, I had read it, I had translated it, but I didn't really understand it until March when my kids were in Manhattan. We were trying to figure out how to get them home. The fear. They talk about fear. And they say, oh yeah, everybody's afraid. Of course, people are dying. I understand viscerally the men and women of the late Roman Empire who speak of their fear before this unintelligible bolt from the blue, that's what Procopius calls it, that was just invisibly killing masses of people around them. So I now have both greater empathy and a more accurate sense of the gravity of the words reflecting fear of this. Gregory of Tours, what does he say about this? He said everybody was terrified. There was a rumor that it was coming. Everybody was terrified. They started doing processions. And so that is, important for helping us understand our forebears and how they wrestled with this terrible tragedy with so many fewer tools than we possess. The real tragedy is our own society where we possess the tools and certain political forces seem to prefer suffering and death to deploying the tools of science to defend our exposed populations.
Does this mean that we should read these sources with more empathy and understanding now?
We have a tendency to think that just because we were smart enough to choose to be born now, we are superior to people who lived in the past. When I decided to be born, when I was born, I knew I was going to be, you know, living in a smarter time. The task, the challenge, and the duty of the historian is to understand the past with all the power of the tools of modern science and history and archaeology, but also to understand the past as the people of the past saw it, with the tools that they had to deal with something completely unexpected, unparalleled in their experience. Remember that ancient science had a very dim view of contagion as a cause of illness. So, and Procopius explicitly addresses this because obviously scientifically disease is caused by imbalance in the liquids inside of you triggered by your environment. And the environment, you know, didn't change that spring in Constantinople. And yet they observed that people who carried the bodies to the mass graves did not die of plague. So doesn't seem like contagion was a factor. In other words, they're so bold, they're so shocked that they are even considering non-scientific, what for them were non-scientific explanations of contagion, and they find evidence against it.
And our ancestors appreciated the importance of quarantine, something that's very much on our minds today.
It's clear that one way or another, they figured out that something was going on through the transmission of merchants and merchandise. We have a letter, one of the very rare letters that survived from a bishop from Gaul from the 7th century. He received a letter from a bishop in southern France. This is Desiderius of Caen. He received a letter from a bishop in southern France saying the plague has broken out. Set up guards at the entrance to your diocese to make sure that no merchants come. Clearly showing that by circa 650 at the latest, they had understood that quarantines and confinement were an effective weapon against bubonic plague, with no idea of the existence of bacteria, with no idea that contagion might work scientifically. They came through tragic experience to one effective solution. Tragically, this knowledge was lost until the letters were published a few years back, and the Venetians had to reinvent it the hard way themselves with their quarantine to keep ships out from entering the harbor of Venice for 40 days until they were sure that there was no plague on board of them.
With this in mind, I was curious to know what Mike would have liked to find out if only he could go back in time to this period.
I would have 10 pages of questions, but I would really like to go to Pelusium, the second port of Egypt, famous for its exports of lentils. According to the written evidence, this is where it broke out and spread from Pelusium to Alexandria and then to the Holy Land and then through Roman shipping to Constantinople and everywhere. Egypt, of course, is the grain source for the bread distributions in Constantinople, in the imperial capital. I would really like to see what was going on the docks of Pelusium in 541. But I'd want to have a lot of antibiotics with me. What was unusual? What had changed? I would love to compare Pelusium in 500 with 541 and see if there's any changes in the fauna or in the urban structures, in the organization of the docks. I have no idea what might have changed, but something changed. And it may not have been at Pelusium. It may have been elsewhere in the infrastructure of communications or in the host populations. But that would be where I would start.
We hadn't talked much about the wider war going on at this time, but thinking back to the siege during the Plague of Athens in our first episode, and also the Spanish flu that struck in the First World War, I was interested to know what effect war had on the Plague of Justinian.
That's a very interesting avenue to pursue, but I would suggest that with the new paleoclimate science and the evidence for the onset of this late antique Little Ice Age in 536, that we see, beginning in 536, broader stress on the population of the Northern Hemisphere, in all likelihood, certainly in the Mediterranean. And then when you add to that the stress of war with its disruption of food supplies and physical violence being done, even with the weaponry of the late Roman army and their adversaries, you certainly would be creating a population that's much more frail. German zoologists also observed that war is a really good thing for rats and that the rat population of Germany multiplied at the end of World War II thanks to the disruption of solid food-preserving structures and even cadavers, which of course can be food for all kinds of rodents.
So how did this outbreak spread to become a pandemic?
The disease spread. We have very, very slim written evidence from anywhere else in the western part of the empire at this time. But it's clear from that it hit Africa, the Roman province of Africa, that is to say, modern-day Tunisia, parts of Algeria, Spain, Italy and Gaul. We now know from the ancient DNA that it also hit Britain in the first outbreak. There are other sources, eyewitnesses, that tell us different things about the plague. There are about different epidemics of plague that broke out in subsequent decades, but it is the first outbreak that is most richly described.
How long did it last? And do we know why it ended?
We don't know what changed to make this tremendous outbreak so imposing and so lasting. It came back. Different scholars count in different ways, but the range so far is between 18 and 30-some. Massive, large-scale epidemic outbreaks between 541, 542, and about 750 in the Mediterranean. Why did it stop? We don't know. We don't know. Did the rats disappear? Were they all killed off by it? And no other host mammal appeared that was suitable? Did something change in the communication structures that meant that people were no longer communicating and transmitting the pathogen as they had been over long distances? Was it something in the genome of the bacterium itself? And here, our work at the Max Planck Harvard Research Center, this wonderful paper that I've referred to by Marcel Keller, who's the lead author, did it as part of his dissertation work at Jena, has detected in two French genomes from the late 6th and from the 7th and 8th century, a deletion of two elements of the genome that have been associated with virulence. And intriguingly, the same deletion shows up in ancient DNA of Yersinia pestis from the 16th and 17th century plague in London and the 18th century plague in Marseille. Is it possible that the bacterium itself evolved into a less lethal form? That would be not terribly surprising from the point of view of evolution, but we don't know yet. These are initial indications. These are not the main virulence factors that everyone is focused on, and rightly so, in terms of the lethality of Yersinia pestis. So the question is open, and only much more extensive and careful and robust and verified genetic analysis, the identification of more tragic victims and the successful extraction and replication and analysis of the genomics of the DNA of the bacterium that laid them low will clarify this.
I was keen to know what the consensus view was regarding the longer-term impacts this huge period of plague had on the populations it affected.
So our ignorance remains great, but it is becoming increasingly circumscribed. And the debate is underway. There's quite a range of opinions on it. Some people, like my friend Kyle Harper, and former student, let it be said, at the University of Oklahoma, views the plague and the environmental crises of the 6th century as being quite significant in the end of the ancient world. Another extreme, my friend John Halden, emeritus of Princeton, views the impact as much more limited, both of environmental and disease change in this period. And then there's a huge spectrum in between. Professor Misha Meyer in Germany has been classified as a quote-unquote maximalist and is not happy with that clearly from his publications. He has characterized his own opinion as seeing the first outbreak as very serious and having very serious consequences, both for the economy and especially for the culture, but believes that subsequent outbreaks were less severe, had less impact. I myself think from the evidence from the first outbreak and now from the ancient DNA is unambiguous. Certainly the first epidemic of plague was extremely consequential. And it's possible to make a similar assessment of a few of the subsequent outbreaks. But I think that we are at the beginning of discovery, not the end.
Given that this was such a huge calamity, lasting for such a long period, and perhaps the first recorded plague in human experience, why isn't the plague of Justinian as notorious as later outbreaks like the Black Death?
First of all, because it's more remote in time and also in place, the memory of the Black Death is particularly strong in European countries, which were not very developed at the time of the Justinianic pandemic and for which there was virtually no written record outside of Gregory of Tours. So there is scant historical evidence in Europe, which has been the locus of memory for the Black Death, because the Black Death hit beyond Europe, but that's where people think of it. Obviously, it may have hit Africa and Central Asia and so forth are under investigation now. So that's one element. The second is that in general, including the Greek and Syriac records, the record keeping, the record preservation, we know that there are a lot of lost histories and so forth, diminishes greatly in the late 6th century, and certainly the 7th century is almost empty of historical. There are only a few Greek historians and very minor Latin historians writing, surviving from the 7th century. So the written record was not strong. It's been a tremendous exploit, achievement of historians and archaeologists and archaeoscientists to begin to reconstruct this really, truly forgotten pandemic. I had a pretty serious graduate education, and I came out of that not thinking that in the end of the ancient economy, whether it was the fall of the Roman Empire or not, in the end of the ancient economy, this disease had a big role to play, whereas everyone recognized it for the Black Death, where you can go to city archives and you can actually look at mortalities in Florence, in Lucca, around the entire, all of Europe. You can see people's reacting to the death and giant bound, for example, in marriages and the concentration of wealth, because plague is a very good thing if you survive, because there's a lot of wealth that didn't disappear that you're going to inherit. So there's an increase in per capita wealth. We're able to see agrarian workers in Britain demanding now that they get meat in addition to beer and porridge for doing harvest, for doing field work. And they're able to do so because we can tell that this reflects the shrinking of supply of labor and therefore the increase in the value of labor. So the Black Death is just much better documented. I mean, Samuel Pepys, people know about him and they read him. Far fewer people read Procopius, unfortunately. He's quite a fascinating writer. So there's that element, the written record for the entire period of the 6th and 7th and 8th centuries is much thinner than for the late Middle Ages and early modern period. The 18th century, we know the ship that brought it into Marseille. We know the merchants who thwarted the quarantines to make their quick buck and brought the ship with plague from the Ottoman Empire, brought the goods into Marseille and set off the final outbreak. So it's in part a general ignorance of this crucial period in which Europe and North Africa and the world of Islam was born in our great Western universities and schools in general. In part, it's the real unevenness of the end, scarcity of surviving written records, which only now is beginning to be supplemented by the amazing work of archaeologists. And we're at the very beginning, three studies, three articles since 2013, the archaeogenetic rediscovery of this terrible disease and its impact.
As our conversation ended, I asked Mike what else he thought it was important for us all to appreciate about this somewhat forgotten pandemic.
Really, that we're just at the beginning of understanding it. And that the wonderful advances of classical philology in understanding the language of the text and in identifying texts that are relevant to this event, the wonderful advances of archaeology and the wonderful advances of archaeoscience are going to allow us to reconstruct in its very tragic and perhaps in some places not so tragic details whatever else it was clearly one of the major health events in the history of the ancient world and in the birth of the transition point between the ancient world and the Middle Ages.
Before you go, we wanted to play you a bonus conversation which we couldn't quite fit into episode one. It's a fascinating discussion I had with Dr. Abigail Buglass from Oxford's Faculty of Classics about the authors who wrote in the period between the Plague of Athens and this Plague of Justinian, and the way they described the disease.
There seems to have been this idea that one can always be threatened by plague, and we know this because poets such as Lucretius and Virgil were actually interested in writing about plague and how it would affect society broadly, but also individuals and their behavior. So there was a real preoccupation with what disease would do to people, not only physically with the symptoms, and they would give detailed descriptions, but also in terms of their moral behavior and even their religious behavior as well. There was a real preoccupation, which does suggest that this is something that the readers of Lucretius would have been very familiar with, this idea of this threat of disease.
The main source we're going to be talking about during this period is Lucretius. What do we know about him?
Actually, we know very, very little about Lucretius. He's actually quite a shadowy figure. We know that he died in the mid to late 50s BC. There is debate about exactly when his lifetime was. He wrote this remarkable poem called the De Rerum Natura, which is also known as On the Nature of the Universe, sometimes known as On the Nature of Things. And it's really a poem that focuses on atoms and how everything in the world is made of atoms and void. And Lucretius firmly believed that understanding this was the key, in a sense, to happiness and the key to peace of mind. His poem is based heavily on the philosophical writings of a Greek philosopher called Epicurus. And so Lucretius's poem is an extremely radical poem, which he wrote during the first century BC. It's a poem in Latin, and his poem, which is an epic poem, so it's very, very long. It's divided into six books or chapters, and he describes the universe without involving gods. So he says that gods have nothing to do with it, and everything in the world ever is made up of atoms and void. The way that plague comes into this is that the poem has a really strange ending. And the poem ends very abruptly with a description of the plague at Athens. So Lucretius was writing, in a sense, with Thucydides on his desk, and he was describing the plague at Athens. So he was looking at the plague from hundreds of years earlier, and he has this extremely emotional account of the plague at Athens and what this did to people in a philosophical sense, as well as in a physical sense. So he describes the causes of disease. Thucydides did not venture on the cause of this disease, whereas Lucretius tries to explain the cause. He thinks that understanding things will mean that you're not afraid, and this actually causes, or allows for rather, peace of mind. And so Lucretius describes the plague, he describes the physical symptoms, and then he gets into kind of the nitty-gritty of what this does to people in a moral sense and how it affects not only individuals, but also the community.
And Lucretius's plague commentary is deeply entwined with the coverage from Thucydides, which we met in the previous episode.
There is a lot of communication and dialogue between Lucretius and Thucydides, in a sense. Lucretius is very much building on and slightly retelling Thucydides' account of the plague. And I would agree with that there are these sort of moral lessons that are drawn from the text, from the plague story. Interestingly, there has been a sort of dichotomy traditionally in Thucydides' account, between the kind of the scientific description of the plague and the idea that it is a moral account. And scholars have tended to sort of veer from one to the other, but actually more recently people are much more at ease with the idea that it wasn't Lucretius who sort of inserted the philosophy and the morality into the plague story, but rather that it was actually already there, in some sense at least, even if not quite as domineering, it's there already in Thucydides. Both talk about burial practice, both writers talk about burial. You know, it's supposed to be one of the sort of more tragic elements of the plague, that the dead were just sort of left there and there are piles of people there. And this is, you can see this in paintings like this, Bruegel the Elder's painting of the triumph of death I think is the title of the painting, and there's just heaps of people about, so this really seems to be an affecting idea. Yeah, the idea of neglecting the visitation of the sick is essentially condemned in Lucretius, and he sort of says, you know, you die if you visit the sick, but you're also haunted if you don't visit the sick. And this is interesting in the current time, of course, because there is a sort of fear of people in general, right? We're getting used to socially distancing. I don't want to make this sort of a COVID podcast, but we're sort of learning to keep our distance from people, and people will ask you to keep your distance if you're not. And there is a sort of fear that builds up around each other. And I think it's really clear that there seems to have been a real understanding of this feeling. If you read these plague stories from antiquity, you can see that this was something that they were living with and trying to deal with. I don't especially know what the answers are. I don't know that Lucretius's lessons are necessarily straightforward, other than he wants you to be able to keep your peace of mind. Something that I do find quite fascinating when looking at these ancient plague narratives is the idea that they aren't focused in a way on advice as to how to reduce infection and minimize the chance of contagion. Whereas a lot of articles we can read on Medium, for example, will advise you how to protect yourself. And there's a lot, I mean, there's all the time practical advice, right, about, you know, we should all be wearing masks and protecting each other. And this idea of the responsibility, the collective responsibility to protect each other is prominent in a lot of publications currently, as it should be. Whereas ancient narratives are really focused on how to deal with the moral and psychological effects of plague and of disease. And this is something that is also being written about right now, but I think that there could be more emphasis on how we deal with it actually mentally, because it's causing great mental strain on pretty much everybody who has to learn to live with disease in the air around us, right?
As a philosopher, I was particularly intrigued by the idea that Lucretius might in fact be using this plague outbreak to make a wider moral point on his perception of a world in decline.
It's a really interesting idea, actually, and one that I could definitely think more about, the idea of whether this is all a kind of hint that things are sort of declining. I think, in a sense, this is true, in that the poem obviously ends with death. I like to look at it as it is and consider, what if this is the right ending, and let's just go from there. But there's this really brilliant piece of work that was done in the 90s by a professor at Manchester University called Alessandro Schizzara, and he writes this article called The Palingenesis of Durare Natura, which means the rebirth of the Durare Natura, or On the Nature of the Universe, the rebirth of Lucretius's poem. So he claims that if you zoom out and look at the poem as a whole, it's all about it. The poem kind of dies in a sense at the end, and then it's reborn at the start of the poem, because the start of the poem, it's called the Hymn to Venus, and there's a lot of imagery of new life and birth and generation. I think there's definitely something to the idea of decline at the end of the poem, but I don't think it necessarily needs to be a bleak or depressing idea, if that makes sense. It's dark for sure. You can't get away from that. Plague or pandemic or disease is difficult to live with, but I think Lucretius wants to teach us how to live well. And even if necessary, how to die well, actually. And you can see that as depressing. You can also see it as helping us to better control our lives and where we're going.
I was also interested to know whether Lucretius was talking about the health of politics or the city itself when he was talking about plague.
Certainly my reading of Lucretius's description of the Athenian plague and, you know, his examination of what plague can do to people and how we should deal with it is more about, it's certainly about the city. So in a way, the city, or the Greek word is the polis. So in a way it's political in a sense. It's about public life. It involves burial and things like this. But I think in a sense it's far less political than the coronavirus is now, because we're talking all the time about how our politicians are reacting or acting. And, you know, are we satisfied with what they're doing? Could they be doing more? Could they be doing better? Are they doing too much? Some people would say that, you know, there's this debate raging all the time actually right now, which I found quite fascinating, which is, you know, there's this sort of struggle between the people who claim that there's actually infringement of civil rights. You know, how far is lockdown infringing civil rights? I personally don't really have much time for that, but it's an interesting thing to see this debate kind of raging. And it's brought up interesting questions about the moral behavior that one should be taking and how far this will affect members of the public who maybe who you don't even know. So there's this idea of the public effect of disease and the effect of private behavior on the public more broadly. But it's not so explicitly discussed, at least in my reading of Lucretius. As I say, it's certainly about the city and how the disease rages through Athens. But it's not so explicitly about the political body.
And was plague ever invoked by authors of the time as something which had been brought about by sin or as the result of a curse?
It's really interesting because in the beginning of the play Oedipus Tyrannus, or Oedipus Rex as it's sometimes known, by Sophocles, the play actually starts with this idea of the miasma or the curse. It's a moral curse on the town, and there's a plague on the town. So the two are quite interlinked. The idea of curse or sin and disease, this actually goes back a really long way. And of course, there's the idea in the book of Exodus in the Bible, the 10 plagues of Egypt are a kind of, in a sense, a punishment for arrogance on the part of humanity. What is fascinating is that plague in antiquity and before can be both a response to sin, but it can also be an indication of sin, and it can also cause sin. So it's extremely intertwined with the idea of sin or moral curses, I suppose. But Lucretius would be really explicitly against such an idea that, you know, it's some sort of punishment from God for wrongdoing. He's giving the rational scientific reasons for plague. Or he's giving potential reasons, at least. He doesn't claim to know all the answers. He gives many different suggestions and then leaves it to the reader.
Mike had mentioned rediscovering something fresh in text that he'd read for years because of his experience of COVID. Something that resonated strongly with me. I asked Abigail whether she was looking at the works of any of these authors in a new light.
Yeah, something that's been really striking to me in kind of rereading Lucretius's plague and looking at other versions of disease from antiquity, but also into modernity. So, for example, if you look at Camus' La Peste, something that's really striking is that anxiety is quite prominent as an effect and a really important effect of disease. Another thing apart from anxiety, and perhaps it's intertwined, is loneliness and isolation. This comes up as well. So Lucretius talks about the isolation of the ill. And this has also been discussed now with COVID-19. You know, we've been thinking about the older people who are alone, perhaps they don't have a family anymore, and or they don't have a partner anymore, and they are alone in the houses, and or there's people in care homes who can't be visited by their families. Families can't comfort each other by putting their arm around each other at a funeral. This idea of isolation is really important. But Lucretius talks about, yeah, how people were basically afraid to visit each other and they were afraid to visit their loved ones. And what's super interesting is that Lucretius and before him Thucydides, in fact, they describe the physical symptoms of the disease in great detail, and they're extremely grim. And Lucretius ends with his list of symptoms with the cure, which would be, you know, cutting off their own limbs. People would cut off their own limbs to try and cure themselves of this horrible disease, and they were flinging themselves in rivers and all sorts of things. But he says the worst thing of all, and Thucydides says this too, the worst thing of all was the fact that the victim of the disease would just give up all hope and lie there despondent. And this was the worst thing of all. So all these horrible symptoms are listed, and then the worst thing of all is despair. So I really think we could care more about this despair and fear and anxiety. and maybe take care of our minds as well as our bodies.
You've been following the story of the Plague of Justinian, the second episode in our 10-part series on the history of pandemics. Next time, we're heading for what's arguably the most famous and most deadly outbreak of plague in human history, the Black Death. I hope you can join me then. I'm Peter Milliken, and you've been listening to Future Me.
Future Makers was produced in-house at the University of Oxford. The show was presented by Peter Milliken. Our voice actor at the beginning of the show was Liz McCarthy. The soundtrack was created by Richard Watts, and the show was produced by Ben Harwood and me, Steve Pritchard. Thanks again for listening to Future Makers.